ever feel that God is invisible? That he is absent from the world? That he might not be active right now? Do you ever wonder how we should act in a world where others seem more powerful? Where governments seem to be in total control? Where God's people get sidelined? Did you know there's a Bible book all about that? Over the next few weeks, I'm going to be sharing my sermon series from the book of Esther. Esther's a book where God's name doesn't even come up once. But when we look carefully, God is extremely active. It's a book with conspiracies, misuse of power, supposed coincidences, relationships, and far more. Are you intrigued? Well, let's dive in, shall we? Esther chapter 7, whole of the chapter. So, the king and Haman went to Queen Esther's banquet, and as they were drinking wine on the second day, the king asked Queen Esther, "What is your petition? It will be given you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted." Then Queen Esther answered, "If I have found favour with you, your majesty, and if it pleases you, grant me my life, this is my petition, and spare my people, this is my request. For I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed and annihilated. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet, because no such distress would justify disturbing the king." King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, "Who is he? Where is he? The man who has dared to do such a thing?" Esther said, "An adversary, an enemy, this vile Haman." Then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. The king got up in a rage, left his wine, and went out into the palace garden. But Haman, realizing that the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. Just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banqueting hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. The king exclaimed, "Will he even molest the queen while she is with me in the house?" As soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs attending the king, said, "A pole reaching to a height of 50 cubits stands by Haman's house. He had it set up for Mordecai, who spoke up to help the king. The king said, 'Impale him on it.' So they impaled Haman on the pole he had set up for Mordecai. Then the king's fury subsided." She knows, but she hasn't told them that she knows. He doesn't know that she knows. Yeah, he knows something that she does not know. And he doesn't know a lot, but he does know that he wants to know what they know. I mean, what's going on? That is the situation we find ourselves in Esther this evening. You see, here in Esther chapter 7, there are a whole series of revelations. Revelations that we know all about. We've been seeing from behind the director's chair. But revelations that the characters in our story do not know about. And that fits the book of Esther when you think about it. Do you remember what we've been seeing? We're meant to be seeing behind the scenes, peeking behind the curtain, discovering what's going on in this world that is seemingly missing God. Because the message of Esther is, when we look carefully, when we take a second look, as we spot the underground current, we're going to see that there is more going on than on the surface. And that is illustrated for us this evening, particularly as we see all the threads of the Esther story pulling together, as all the characters are brought up to speed and they all make decisions in light of it. And it helps us to answer this question: how can we make wise decisions in a world missing God? How can we make wise decisions in this world missing God? See, everyone has to make decisions daily. And those decisions are always impacted by what we know. Who do we think's in charge? That's going to make all the difference. And we need to understand that in order to make wise decisions. Just imagine you were someone in Xerxes' kingdom. Remember, it spanned the world. You were someone living at the time. As the tables turn in Esther, you would need to know which side is in power, which side is going to win. Should you go along with Haman's decree, or should you not? The clock is ticking. It's going to have an impact. And the same goes for today, doesn't it? In this kingdom of this world, who is it who's in charge? Which side is in power? Who's flying the flags this month? Which side is going to win? And that's going to make a massive difference, isn't it, in the way you live your life. Our chapter of Esther this evening revolves around who understands what. You can see that clearly in the number of questions we have in this passage. Just have a look at them quickly. You've got, what is your request? Who is he? What is he doing? And so we're going to take each character in turn. We're going to look at each character this evening and see what they understand. And we're going to see how that affects the story. We're going to see how they live in light of what they know. So let's look at our first person this evening, shall we? Let's look at Esther. What does Esther understand? Verses 1 to 6. We're back at a banquet. If you remember back to Esther chapter 5, this is going to sound pretty familiar. Verse 1. Esther is throwing a banquet, and the king and Haman are coming to it. And deja vu, verse 2, the king asks, as they were drinking wine on the second day, the king again asked, Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted. Now, if you remember the last banquet, Esther didn't actually give an answer to Xerxes. We were left waiting. She's kept the request hidden at this point. So Xerxes and Haman, they don't know what Esther has up her sleeve. What does she know? So the king asks, what's your petition? What's your request? And finally, we get the answer, verse 3. Then Queen Esther answered, if I have found favour with you, your majesty, and if it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. Just notice there, she's specifically answering the king's two questions. He says, give me your petition, give me your request. And she gives her petition, and then she gives her request. Her petition is for the king to grant her life. And her request is for the king to spare the life of her people. You see how Esther here is tying herself to God's people. That's a big point, isn't it? As we've gone through the book of Esther, this is a big deal. There is a connection here being made between Esther and God's people. And at this point, Xerxes and Haman, they have no idea who Esther's people are. But now what do they know? Well, they know that someone is threatening the king's wife. She continues, verse 4. For I and my family have been sold to be destroyed, killed and annihilated. If we'd merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet, because no such distress would justify disturbing the king. See here, she's starting to explain the plot that Haman's concocted. She's actually using the exact language of Haman back in chapter 3, verse 13. Destroyed, killed, annihilated. That is what God's people currently face. Do you remember Haman's plan? Haman, the enemy of God's people, wiping out the entirety of God's salvation plan. It's interesting here what Esther says. If we'd merely been sold as slaves, I mean, if you go back to chapter 3 and you read carefully, that is what Xerxes thinks is going to happen. Xerxes thinks this is a business transaction. This is a solution to a problem. He thought he understood what was going on, but he doesn't. In fact, Esther echoes Haman's words here as she targets the king's heart. As she points out, the king's been duped. This is more than slavery. This is a total destruction of the people. And those people here, it gets personal right now, include Xerxes' wife. Now, it's worth noting here, Esther's not saying that being a slave is an okay thing, but she is appealing to Xerxes' ego. Because if you're the king of Persia, then everything, remember, revolves around you. Do you remember? Looks matter in Persia. And Esther is pointing out really cleverly here that the king has been made out to be a fool. I mean, don't we see this the same today? People only respond to things when they come knocking at the door. People don't care about matters out there. But when the door is knocked on, then it really does matter. And so Xerxes, he doesn't really know what's going on, but he asks the question, who is he? Where is he? The man who dared to do such a thing. You just imagine Haman, can't you? He goes from, I wonder what's going on here, to, oh, those words sound a bit familiar, to, uh-oh. I mean, in the original language, it's as if the king stutters over his words. The author writes this. The king said, he said to the queen, You get this idea of him spitting out his wine at the news, firing off those words like a machine gun. And Esther responds in the same way, verse 6. Esther said, an adversary, an enemy, this vile Haman. The details are left to the very end of the speech. The noose is tightened right up to the last moment. If this was filmed, you could imagine the camera darting from one person to another, not resting long enough on anyone to fully get what they're thinking. Do you see where we are at the end of this bit? Esther has shared what she knows. The king understands what's going on. Haman has clocked what's happening. And so, end of verse 6, Haman was terrified before the king and queen. You see, this thread has been pulled all the way through. Esther's life with that of her people is now in the balance. And now the camera turns to Haman. In light of all this, what does Haman understand? Verse 7. The king got up in a rage, left his wine and went out into the palace garden. But Haman, realizing that the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. See there, the king, he realizes he's been duped. He has to leave the room. He gets up in a rage. Notice the little detail here. He leaves his wine behind. He has to get out of the room as quick as possible. King Headache now has a headache from figuring out what's going to happen next. We haven't seen rage like this since chapter 1 and Queen Vashti. Do you remember when Queen Vashti got replaced? Maybe we're going to have another replacement soon. But rather than following the king out into the garden, the author keeps us with Haman. And we see what Haman understands. See that, verse 7? He understands that his fate is sealed by the king. He realises he's facing his end, just like his wife had warned him, don't be a numpty. And so Haman stays behind to beg the queen for his life. In fact, the phrase stayed behind there is actually the word stood. It's actually the word stood. Haman is the only man in this whole passage who explicitly stands. Just tuck that one away for a minute. It's going to be really important in a moment. But here's the thing. If you're not a eunuch, you're not allowed to be in the room with one of the king's women, and certainly not the queen. So what do? Do you follow the king out into the garden? Well, that's not really a great idea right now, is it? Do you run the other way? Do you try and flee? Well, that's not a terribly good idea either. There really is no good option for Haman here. He sees that his fate's been determined against him by the king, so he stays to beg for his life from Queen Esther. He doesn't have to be very bright to understand that. But Haman understands what's going to happen. In fact, he should have understood it far earlier, shouldn't he? He's going to fall. And that brings us to the last one. What does Xerxes understand? Verses 8 and 10. See, after clearing his head by strolling around the garden, Xerxes walks back into the wine feast. And as he enters through the doors, he sees Haman falling onto the couch where Esther is reclining. What does Xerxes understand? You have to get into Xerxes' head here. Remember what's been going on in this story. Esther threw a banquet for him. Do you remember that? Was the banquet for Haman or for the king? We weren't told. Is there something going on? Then what did Haman want? Well, he wanted to be dressed up as the king. Haman had king desires, didn't he? What's going on here? Then Haman had duped the king into doing something the king didn't really plan to do, which meant Haman was running the show. Haman was in charge. What's going on? And now as Xerxes walks in, and it looks like, in the words of verse 8, will he even molest the queen while she's with me in the house? What does Xerxes understand? Well, he seems to understand that Haman wants to take his place. Haman wants to get him out of the picture. Haman wants to be the king. And so, this is the final straw. Whether Xerxes pieced all of that together or not, that is the excuse he uses to get rid of Haman. But do you notice what's really happening here? Do you remember Haman stayed behind, or more precisely, Haman stood? Then what does he do? Have a look at verse 8. The language is deliberate. Haman falls. Do you remember what his wife had said, those ominous words of chapter 6? Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely fall. Exactly the same wording of chapter 6 as here in chapter 7. You cannot stand, you will fall. In fact, here's a clever one. All the words used of Haman in this chapter echo exactly what Mordecai would not do in the book of Esther. Do you remember? Mordecai would not bow. Mordecai would not stand. Nor was Mordecai terrified. What do we have in this chapter? You have Haman is terrified. Haman stands. And then Haman falls. Haman bows. Where Mordecai was meant to die for not falling down inappropriately before Haman, Haman's going to fall, he's going to die for falling down inappropriately before Esther. Do you see the poetic justice here? What irony there is, what a reversal. But there's one more piece of the puzzle to be unwrapped, and that comes with Harbona, verses 9 and 10. I mean, we all know the classic telltale, don't we, from our school days? I reckon Harbona's probably one of those. He pops in at just the right moment. Coincidence? And he says to the king, Haman, didn't you build a pole? I mean, wasn't that pole meant to be raising up Mordecai? I mean, Mordecai, that same guy who happened to speak up to help the king. You just imagine Haman, can't you, going, shut up, shut up, shut up. It's absolutely comedic. So not only has Haman tried to conquer the kingdom, he's also trying to kill the man who prevented the last coup against King Xerxes. Wait a minute. Just imagine Xerxes' head. Is that all connected? Is that what's going on here? And for the first time in this entire story, the whole of Esther, Xerxes makes a decision. And he says it in plain, straightforward terms. No highfalutin language, just simply this. Impale him on it. And so they do. Poetic justice is done. And with that, the flood of the king's anger subsides. It's a fantastic story, isn't it? How did you feel at the end of that? And there is a reason why, when this story is told today, Jewish people cheer at the end of that verse. Well, hey! But what is the point? What should we take from this? Or to put it in the terms of this passage, what do you understand? Do you remember our vantage point? We've seen this story unfolding. We've known all of this before the characters in the story knew. So what do we understand? With the whole of this book, we're called to see the bigger picture. What is the bigger picture? Well, it's of God working all the loose ends to his plan. Just think about all the different threads that have come together in this passage. Remember how chaotic, how separated they all were. But how they all come together, all without the characters of the story knowing. How Haman's plan, the king's request, the pole, the assassination, they're all separate, but they've all come together. How God's plan has been worked out through the actions of these people in the city of Susa. That's meant to give us great courage and confidence to make wise decisions in the world missing God. So the grand point of the book of Esther, we're going to see it in a couple of weeks' time, is to remember the story of Esther. That is the application of the book of Esther. Remember this story. Remember that even in the midst of a godless world, even in the midst of a world that is missing God, God is still at work. Those reading this story originally are called to remember this as they're waiting for the Messiah to come. And so how much more can we remember this on this side of the cross? Just think, in those situations where we simply can't see how anything could go right, and things seem hopeless, when we ask, who knows how this is all going to end? In those situations, we can confidently say that someone does know. And that someone is working all things together to his plan. And that someone can be trusted. Or as Paul might say in Romans chapter 8, we can know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. So we should leave really confident that God has everything in hand this evening. Now, of course, that's not the end of the story. You could end the story there. We still have more to see. We still have a few more weeks in Esther. We still have more to understand. But we can give great praise to God this evening, that he is in charge of all things. We can have confidence even in the midst of things looking like he's missing. Thank you so much for listening. Any feedback or questions can be sent to podcast@david-couch.com, and I'll catch you again next time.